From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, traditional labor bargaining smacks up against the political and economic chaos of 2019 as the UAW strike against GM moves toward its third week.
You can see both sets of the argument. The unions want maximum security because they don't know what's going to change in the next 2 or 3 years. And the companies want maximum flexibility because they figure things are going to change.
Mental health counselors worry newly rewritten state licensing rules could leave them unable to diagnose and treat patients.
So if counselors, if their fears are realized and that they're stopped from practicing, a lot of people could be left without care.
And the Detroiter who'd soon be the first black woman to visit every recognized country in the world.
The world is more black and brown than it is white, so I think I can actually blend in more often than not.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent study finds when people have health insurance, their overall financial situation improves.
There's really clear evidence that one of the main purposes and main outcomes of gaining health insurance coverage is to improve financial outcomes.
More on that later in the program. But first, the UAW strike against General Motors is heading toward the three-week mark, casting giant clouds over this bargaining table, the chaos over possible impeachment, the gloomy state of affairs for manufacturing, and the deepening federal corruption probe into top UAW leadership. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House is here with us for our weekly check-in. Daniel, I want to start with the new reporting that you've done with your colleague Robert Snell about the corruption probe. Tell us what's happening.
Well, two top leaders in the UAW, former Secretary of Treasury Gary Castile and a guy by the name of Danny Troll, who was a deputy out in Region 5, where the president, Gary Jones, came from, are cooperating witnesses with the federal authorities in this continuing investigation. We reported that, actually, I think it posted last night in the Detroit News and is in print editions this morning. This is, I think, yet another turn of the screw. These individuals were mentioned but not identified in the criminal charges against Vance Pearson, who was the director of Region 5, which stretches from St. Louis all the way out to California. It's 17 states, huge region. And it was that region that sponsored the annual Palm Springs Conference that was supposed to be a 3 to 4 day thing, but for the top leadership, it ended up being, in some cases, a month or more of having poolside villas and going out to fancy steak dinners and buying $60,000 worth of cigars and cigar cutters, $400 bottles of Cristal champagne, and the list goes on and on and on. And this was all done with union money, not the corporate money that was involved in the training center scandals, which just kind of began this whole thing.
Okay, so it started with that, the different convictions that we watched happen at FCA, and that was different. So this is peeling the skin of the onion?
Yes, and I think you've gone from the training center monies, which are bargained with the companies, it's company money, into these things that were using union money, and the union is essentially funded two ways. One, through the training centers, which are separate entities legally, and then through dues money that comes in from members all over the country.
These members who are right now the General Motors members who are getting $250 a week in strike.
Exactly right.
We do need to note that current President Gary Jones and past President Dennis Williams have not been charged with any crimes. The feds are referring to them by pseudonyms. But your report with Robert Snell does spell out quite a list of potential crimes the federal prosecutors are exploring. What are those?
Well, I think they're looking at things like money laundering, wire fraud, various kinds of fraud. The list is fairly long. And
I saw embezzlement, bribes,
embezzlement, kickbacks. Yeah, yeah, kickbacks. I mean, we expect that there's going to be additional indictments coming, but we don't know that for sure, obviously. There have been various individuals who've been named by pseudonyms in federal documentation, so it's really a kind of a question of whether these people are cooperating and to what extent they're cooperating and what effect that will have on their prosecution and or sentencing.
And you're reporting that it's a former deputy, Danny Troll, and a retired UAW Secretary Treasurer, Gary Castile. How important are these two individuals and their knowledge to this investigation?
Well, I think in the case of Gary Castile, his Secretary Treasurer, I mean, there are only two officers in the United Auto Workers who are essentially represent nationally, the president and the secretary treasurer. The vice presidents who head the departments for General Motors, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler in some cases, rank a little bit below. Now, they're all members of the International Executive Board, which is 15 or 16 members who essentially run the union as the management, but also as the overseer. So they don't really have a clear governance structure like you would see, say, in a corporation where you have a board of directors and then you have management that is overseen by the board of directors. In their case, they have one board.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes as we look at the clouds that are looming over the bargaining table as the UAW and General Motors strike moves toward week three. So that's the corruption cloud. Let's shift to, as you put it in your column today, impeachment chaos and economic churn. Starting with the impeachment chaos, what are we seeing? What more are we seeing as this moves forward?
Well, I mean, I think the car companies, it's interesting, you know, the president has been very strong, as he would say, in his support of the auto companies and a lot of the people who work for them. He's badgered them from time to time about decisions that they've made. But in general, I think he sees them as emblematic of the industrial Midwest that delivered him to the White House. And he also has said, look, I'm gonna rewrite NAFTA. Everybody hates NAFTA. I hate NAFTA. Well, here we are. NAFTA 2.0 has been written. It's called the USMCA. But it's stuck in Congress and it's stuck in the House.
Well, and as a matter of fact, yesterday when Nancy Pelosi held that press conference, she started by talking about the need to work and move ahead on the USMCA. She even charged reporters, ask me questions. Don't ask me questions about the impeachment investigation. Ask me about USMCA.
Well, fine. And she's also said that she's going to hold up USMCA to answer the concerns of her members, which basically means they're going to insist on rewriting pieces of it. And the president has said, I'm not rewriting it. And he's made veiled threats that he not only would he not rewrite it, if they wouldn't pass it, he would just start levying tariffs on Canadian and Mexican vehicles that are imported into the United States, which, by the way, are built by Detroit companies.
Right. And I'm going to say, and talk like that is sending shudders through executive ranks at the automotive
right.
companies.
So to the point here, these companies are sitting here looking at this chaos in Washington and thinking, we're not going to get any clarity here. We're not going to get any clarity on a NAFTA 2.0. We're not going to get any clarity on emissions and what the emissions regs are going to be. Trump wants one thing. California wants another. Ford has cut a deal with California. General Motors is sitting back and watching. So, it's a mess. I mean, and the reason they have so little clarity, they can't even set some of their MPG targets, I'm told, for 2021, which is not very far away. So there's a lot of things here that are just on hold. And, you know, they're trying to negotiate a new four-year contract where you have the companies wanting maximum flexibility and the union wanting maximum security. And if you look at the situation, you can see both sets of the argument. The unions want maximum security because they don't know what's going to change in the next 2 or 3 years. And the companies want maximum flexibility because they figure things are going to change and we're going to have to deal with it.
And as you point out, September was the worst month for U.S. manufacturing in more than a decade. I have seen the terms manufacturing recession being used.
Yeah, and there's just a report that came out this morning, I believe, on the service sector, and it's soft as well, and the market's tanking again.
So you say the new normal is chaos.
The new normal, I think, at least through the end of this administration, is going to be some degree of chaos. And, you know, one of the reasons you're seeing this slowdown in manufacturing is business is not making investments because they don't know what kind of environment they're going to be making the investments in and where they're going to be 12 or 18 or 24 months. You know, some people say, well, business always, yes, they hate uncertainty. It's easy to blow that off, but it is a critical component in decision making.
So when we talk about, as you point out in your column today, these contracts that right now these negotiators are trying to work out for UAW and General Motors, they are not historically built to cope with these rapid changes. Where does this go?
Well, that's the real question, and we're kind of stuck here watching this and getting dribs and drabs of information. You've got the union leadership trying to negotiate something, yet the president is his credibility has been really damaged by the ongoing investigation. So I think that's been a concern, and they've discussed this at the highest levels of the union. They recognize that this is a problem. and how they're trying to manage their way through it. In fact, there was an executive board meeting, I think 2 days before they sent the folks out on strike. And they were discussing whether or not they needed to make a change at that point. Did somebody need to come in and take over for Gary Jones? And because he could not be leading the negotiations, but they felt we're too close to the deadline here. We don't have anybody that's going to be as up to speed, and we've got to, you know, go with the horse we got, so to speak. And so that's what they're doing. But these contracts, I mean, this is 70, 80 years of tradition, and people have expectations. They're always looking for a little bit more, irrespective of what the macroeconomic environment is. But we're operating in an environment that changes very quickly. You know, we have a global economy. When these contracts were first coming together in the 40s and the 50s, when Walter Reuther was leading the union and they were gaining amazing things in terms of that have become part of the landscape for all of us, whether it's union or non-union, that economy has changed. It's global. It moves very quickly. The United States has rivals economically. It had the Detroit car companies, their foreign automakers sell more vehicles in the United States than the Detroit 3 do. So, I mean, they are not the king of the hill necessarily anymore.
So as the union rightly points to the good times and the good years since mm-hmm. they last got anything, and that's correct, you're saying the companies are looking ahead and see a whole bunch of clouds and a whole bunch of uncertainty.
Yeah, and I think the companies, you know, they're happy to share the profits. They're talking about sweetening profit sharing. But what's important for people to remember is that that is variable compensation. So people, those hourly workers get paid well and get paid profit sharing when the company does well. When it doesn't, they don't get paid. And what they're trying to avoid is having a lot more higher fixed costs. General Motors currently has the highest fixed costs in the industry. They had the highest fixed costs when they went into bankruptcy in 2009. 10 years later, they still have the highest fixed costs.
Did you think we'd be nearing in on 3 weeks with this strike?
I was thinking two, but I think the vibe is such that... frankly, I think we're going to be having this conversation early next week. I suspect we'll go through the weekend. But, you know, who knows? These things, once they start to move, they move quickly. Now, what's happening now is they're having multiple what they call flip-flops. I give you a proposal, you give me a proposal. That's one flip-flop. A flip, a flop. Mm. And they've had multiple of those, but they're not there yet.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks so much, Daniel.
You bet.
Coming up, the first black woman to visit every country in the world could be a woman from Detroit.
I think so much of my journey is about disrupting the narrative of what the average traveler looks like and also the assumption about who can afford travel.
We'll meet her after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Most of us feel pretty proud of ourselves for being able to get overseas and visit a few faraway countries. But you can aim higher and go bigger, like Jessica Nabongo has. This Detroiter is a writer, a photographer. She shares her travels on her blog, The Catch Me If You Can. Her goal, to possibly be the first black woman to visit every single country recognized by the United Nations, 195 countries. And guess what? Jessica Nabongo is just one country away from that goal. She leaves for the Seychelles on Saturday, and she's here with us now. Jessica, how long did it take for you to pull this travel feat off?
So I've been traveling internationally since I was 4. My family is from Uganda, and so my parents have a love of travel. And besides going to Uganda and the UK when we were younger visiting family, we went to places like Jamaica, the Bahamas, Mexico. And so my sort of wanderlust, I suppose, just went, it grew from there. I've always been a geography nerd. And so post-university, I did my first trip across the Atlantic without my family, and I went to Paris, Madrid, and London. And after that, I was like, I survived. I can do this. So it's really been a journey that's taken a lifetime so far. But in February 2017, I really set out on this feat. And at that point, I was at 60 countries. So I finished the last 135 in about 2.5 years.
Let's get back a little about just the nuts and bolts of this. It's an ambitious goal and it's costly. So in terms of money, how were you able to pull this off financially?
Well, I had savings. I also work for myself. So I have a luxury boutique travel agency that I run called Jet Black. I also do partnerships with brands around content creation on social media. I've had a few partners in terms of like tourism boards and some hotels who've offered me free accommodations or free tours, and that has definitely helped. And then using social media, primarily Instagram, I've built a community of people who have been supporting me for a few years and was able to also raise money with their support.
So you got creative. You got creative.
Yeah, I did.
All right. I have to ask you about, and I have traveled on my own as a woman, and so I'm wondering for you as a woman on her own in some pretty remote parts of the world, what kind of safety concerns do you have or safety precautions that you take? I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, for example, it was about a year ago when a 36-year-old American woman was murdered in Costa Rica. She was on her own on her dream vacation. So talk about safety.
Well, so I've done about 90 countries on my own, and that's across 6 continents. And with regard to safety, I typically am connected with local people just because that's the way that I prefer to explore country. But I think beyond that, I use positive energy. I think a lot of the narrative around women traveling solo and it being scary, I think it's overplayed. The fact of the matter is most assaults on women, if we're talking sexual assault or whatever, most assaults happen to women by people that they know. So statistically speaking, so actually traveling may in fact be safer. And I think for me, I do feel like being positive has drawn positive energy to me, because when I think about all of my travel experience, not just to 194 countries, but I lived in London, I lived in Rome, I lived in Benin in West Africa, I lived in Japan, and I felt safe in most of those situations. Well, those, all of them. But so I think the concern about safety is definitely exaggerated. And I definitely, for me, I would say my caution or precaution boils down to me emitting positive energy. And I feel like that has been the reason that this journey has gone off without any like hiccups in terms of me being in unsafe situations.
You know, we hear talk, Jessica, of blending in if you're spending time in a country and trying to, you know, live like a local. I have to imagine as a Black woman from Detroit, that was not always possible, was it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the world is super diverse, but the world is more Black and brown than it is white. So I think I can actually blend in more often than not.
But what about the countries where you did not? What was that like? How did the locals respond to you and your journey and your story?
Yeah, a lot of picture taking. So in places like Central Asia, you know, like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, there were a lot of picture taking. I remember me and a friend, we were at the Taj Mahal, and there was a queue of people taking pictures with me. And it was so funny because we're like, you are at the Taj Mahal and you want to take a picture of me? But, you know, a lot of people don't see tourists that look like me. And so I think that's also a really important part of this journey, like helping to normalize Black women, Black men, and, you know, people of color traveling around the world simply for tourism.
What about places that you visited that were striking in people's acceptance of you as a woman of color, where you really felt, you know, there was a clear absence of racism? Have you got examples of that?
I think it's most of the world, honestly. I think, you know, the U.S. is a very particular place. And for me, I can't think of like an exception, because while, yes, I've been to places and they have not really seen people who look like me, so it brings a lot of curiosity, I'm always met with warm, open arms. And, you know, particularly traveling alone, it's been amazing because, like, I just came back to Detroit 2 days ago and I had to stop through Jordan. And while I was there, I met up with my tour guide. And like when we saw each other, we cried because we, in the 6 days that I was in Jordan last year, we really became like family. As Americans, I know that there's a preoccupation with race, and there should be because it is very much a part of our everyday lives here. But for me, what I enjoy about being outside of this country is that I don't have to think about it that much. For sure, definitely at borders. But once I'm inside of the borders and I'm just hanging out, there's not a preoccupation with my race.
So, Jessica, the travel blogging industry, the Instagram industry, it can be a white space. So how do you navigate that as a woman of color?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I feel like I've learned a lot on this journey in terms of how people value people of color in the travel space. Again, I think so much of my journey is about disrupting the narrative of what the average traveler looks like, and also the assumption about who can afford travel. But yeah, it's definitely been a challenge. You know, I have other friends who are visiting every country, and oftentimes they get hotels to give them complimentary stays, or they get tourism boards to fly them in. And I may ask those same tourism boards and those same hotels, and they'll tell me no, even though I have a higher following, even though, you know, I have a larger media footprint. You know, I've experienced very, very clear and blatant racism in this travel space as it relates to being a so-called travel influencer, for sure.
Jessica, what are some of the easily overlooked, underappreciated countries or someplace that you cannot wait to go back and visit again that surprises you that you feel that way?
I love that question. I love Jordan. Jordan is definitely my favorite country in the Middle East. The people, the food, the culture, the sights. I loved Iran. I think Iran is one of the most beautiful countries in the world. People are very open and kind. Uzbekistan is also incredibly beautiful. Kenya, I've been so many times and I just love it. It's like a second home to me at this point. Where else? I think that's a good list.
So you're aiming to be the first Black woman to visit all the recognized countries in the world. Who will document that? How will you verify that?
There is an organization called Nomad Mania who's already verified that I had been to, I think at that point, it was around 170 countries. So they're one of the verifying bodies in the counting country space.
Okay.
But other than that, there's not like an official title or award. And that's why when we talk about it, we say first documented, because, you know, by going to my website or whatever, we have the documentation that I've done this.
Jessica, somebody sitting and listening to us talk at a desk or behind a counter or at work, at school, and wondering what it would be like to travel more. What advice do you have for people to kind of get moving in this direction?
Yeah, I think the biggest piece of advice I have is travel is just moving outside of your comfort zone. It's moving outside of your everyday life. So it may not necessarily be passport stamps for some people, but, you know, I think hop in a car, rent a car, drive 50 miles from your home, drive 100 miles from your home, go someplace new in your city. If you do want to travel outside of the country, I always say chase the deal, not the destination. You know, as recently as last week, I think I saw like a $500 flight from Detroit to Rome nonstop. I think, you know, travel is definitely becoming more accessible in terms of pricing. So it's definitely a great time to get out there and explore the world.
So when are you leaving for the Seychelles to make your last country?
On Saturday.
Well, there we go. We caught you between trips. Jessica Nabongo, her travel blog is The Catch Me If You Can. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You hear Bryce Hoffman right here on Michigan Radio, bringing you stories from West Michigan all the time. Well, now you'll soon hear Bryce in a new way as the creator and host of a new podcast that's coming to Michigan Radio October 7th called Same, Same, Different. Bryce Hoffman, describe what you're going to explore over the 5 episodes of Same, Same, Different.
Yeah, we're looking at the idea of otherness, that feeling that you're different and sometimes even less than the people around you. And while we can all feel that way at times, it's really the show's really about these people coming from marginalized communities who really get hit the hardest by this. People of color, LGBTQ folks, people with disabilities, religious minorities, those sort of identities. So we're looking at their experiences and how we survive that every day. But not just how we survive it, but like how we do that without losing our sanity.
And what pointed you in this direction? Just what sparked this this idea of this podcast for you?
Well, it was a couple things. Honestly, it started out as a way to get more people from marginalized communities listening to our station. I have a lot of friends who are proud of me and the work I do, but they aren't the typical Michigan radio listener. So they really would only listen if I, you know, shared a story with them or told them to listen at a certain time. So I wanted to get them to engage in our station more deeply and engage in our content more deeply. So it started out kind of as a way to get the not typical Michigan radio listener to listen, but also to get more people of color and folks from these communities on our station, on our air. I think we have this great capacity to tell stories, and I wanted to hear more diverse, you know, stories being told.
Well, you start same, same, different right off the bat, diving into how to survive otherness with your sanity intact by sharing an incident from your days at a predominantly white, all-boys Catholic school in Detroit. Let's take a listen.
This particular day, I'm just at the lunch table eating my mom's spaghetti with a bunch of my white friends from the suburbs, mostly lacrosse and hockey players. We're talking about the NHL playoffs, because back in 2011, the Red Wings were actually in the playoffs. And one of my friends stops and he looks at me and says, "You know, Bryce, we like you a lot." Now, when he said that, I'm thinking, oh, he's probably going to invite me to his house to watch the game later, or he's going to ask if I'm going to try out for lacrosse next year. I'm thinking something positive. But then he continues. He goes, "You know, Bryce, we like you a lot because you're not like all the other black kids." I know, right? It's terrible. I almost spit out the spaghetti.
You know, Bryce, I'm cringing hearing those words. "We like you because you're not like all the other black kids." But it seems like the guys around the table weren't cringing. Why do you think that is?
It's simple. It's because they've never really had that experience. They've never had to think about their race in that way. They were the majority at the school. They were the majority in the communities that they live in, mostly in the suburbs. And at the school, it's a school designed for those type of students. But me and all the other kids of color, we were always in situations where we were forced to think about our race in contrast to whiteness.
So that kind of experience, how did that shape what you wanted this podcast to be?
I just found myself wanting to hear more people who had been through similar things and had to navigate spaces like this all the time. It's something that we often in America, we really think about race and identity in our silos. We think, oh, the black community, the gay community, the Muslim community. We don't think about how people from all of those communities have to share the same space and have to really find a way to get along with one another and settle our differences. So I wanted the podcast to really share these experiences that of me feeling like an outsider and have other people talk about it, because I think there's something innately human to that feeling that even if you've never been in that situation, you can relate to.
So who are some of the people we're going to hear from in these episodes? How'd you choose them?
We've got a lot of great writers and thinkers. Some of them are Kiese Lehmann, Austin Channing Brown, and Virgie Tavar, just to name a few. But we really wanted people who had been thinking deeply about identity for a long time. We wanted people who could make me think and get our audience to process what they've experienced, but maybe with some new language that they hadn't heard before and maybe some new ways of looking at things.
And you're actually asking everyone out there to be a part of this and share personal experiences where a young person has affected someone's thinking about identity and difference. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so our last episode, the theme is be a kid, and that's because kids can often be open and accepting in a ways that like adults aren't. So we wanted to hear stories where adults learned lessons like this from kids, people who are thinking about the world in a much more innocent way.
You know, as you talk about that, I'm thinking about the actual explosion of national reaction to that viral video of the two toddlers that came out of New York. You had one little tiny child who was white and little tiny child who was black, and they ran to each other and leaped into each other's arms. And that really struck a chord with the country, didn't it?
Yeah, my girlfriend shared it with me like 3 days straight, like of just different people like reacting to the video.
Yeah, so that's kind of what you're saying. Then show us when you've learned a lesson from a young person.
Yeah, yeah. Times where, you know, maybe you thought one way about a different community or certain identities, and a kid got you to, like, you know, reevaluate that. And if you want to share your story with us, just go to michiganradio.org/different to find out how.
Bryce, what are you getting from these conversations that you've been having for these podcasts? I mean, what's been the most surprising thing for you as host?
I think the thing that I'm getting a lot from these conversations is just how normal my experience is for people from marginalized communities. I guess I knew that other people had gone through similar things. That's why I wanted to do the podcast, but I didn't realize to what extent I would find myself relating to people from Mississippi and people from San Francisco and people who are decades older than me and who haven't really had a life that similar to mine outside of the fact that we are the other in the room a lot. So there's just a lot I'm learning about how connected we all are in these experiences.
Bryce Huffman, host of Same, Same, Different. The new podcast begins Monday, October 7th, available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. And by the way, there will be a launch party for Same, Same, Different that Monday evening at Stella's Lounge in downtown Grand Rapids. All the details are there for you at michiganradio.org. Bryce Huffman, congratulations on the podcast and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
After the break, we talk about a recent study finding when people have health insurance, their overall financial situations improve.
In Michigan specifically, we saw decreased bankruptcies, we saw decreased overdrawing your credit card, decreased unpaid bills.
That comes up after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Affordable Care Act was designed to give more Americans the financial security of health insurance. Well, we've had a pretty clear understanding. People who gained health insurance through the ACA have seen their physical health improve. How about financial health? Well, that's the question that University of Michigan researcher Sarah Miller sought to answer. She joined with a team of social scientists from the University of Chicago, Northwestern University, and the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And together, they dug into the central question, have people who have health insurance thanks to the ACA seen their finances improve? Sarah Miller is the Sanford R. Robertson Assistant Professor of Business Administration at the Ross School of Business. So good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with that core question. Did health insurance improve people's financial health?
Yes, I think at this point, there's really clear evidence that one of the main purposes and main outcomes of gaining health insurance coverage is to improve financial outcomes. As an economist, we tend to think of insurance as a financial product fundamentally. So, of course, there could be also great health benefits or benefits to other aspects of your life. But a lot of times we think of insurance as fundamentally a financial product. What we've done in this study, and other researchers have confirmed this in other studies as well, is look at people who were experiencing benefits from the Affordable Care Act and compare them to those who didn't receive those benefits. Most of our variation from this is coming from the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansions, which are optional for states. Some states decided to take these expansions up. And
such
some states,
as Michigan.
Such as Michigan. Yeah. And some states did not. And so it creates a very natural comparison group for us to explore this question.
By what financial markers did you see improvement? How do we know that finances are better?
So we were working with a team that included researchers from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And they have access to really great data on financial outcomes. What they have essentially is a 5% random sample of everyone in the United States, so millions and millions of people's credit records, like the report that you would have at TransUnion or Experian. These actually are coming from Equifax. And these are de-identified records, so we don't see any identifying information. But what we do observe is basically everything that is on a person's credit report. So we can see things like paying your bills on time, overdrawing your credit card, having your debt sent to a third-party debt collector, and even really extreme things like going into bankruptcy or having other serious problems that would appear in the court system. So our first study looked at the whole nation and essentially compared states that expanded Medicaid eligibility through the ACA and states that did not. And what we found was, particularly when it came to unpaid debts, there were reductions in the states that expanded the Medicaid, or that implemented the Medicaid expansion through the Affordable Care Act, relative to states that didn't. So that really seemed like an important finding for us, that there were, you know, just being able to pay your bills on time seemed to be improved by gaining Medicaid eligibility.
Why are the financial effects of having health insurance so far-reaching? Because this really is going right through people's lives.
I think that's a great question. I think it's kind of a combination of a few different things. First of all, one thing you should keep in mind when you think about the financial effects of Medicaid is that the people that are benefiting from this program tend to be very disadvantaged to begin with. So in our follow-up study, looking specifically at people who enrolled in Medicaid in Michigan, I was really struck by sort of the high levels of financial distress people were experiencing before they got Medicaid. So average income upon enrollment in Medicaid in Michigan is about 39% of the federal poverty level. So for an individual, that's about $4,400 a year. Or a family of three, that's about $7,500 a year. So they're starting out from a very disadvantaged position in terms of their labor market earnings. And then when you look at what's showing up on their credit report, they're also very disadvantaged financially. On average, they have about $2,000 in unpaid bills on their credit report. Now think about this: if you're someone making $4,400 a year and you have $2,000 of unpaid bills, about 1,000 of that are medical bills. So when you think about just how expensive medical care is and sort of the many interrelationships between being low income, having perhaps a chronic illness or having another kind of illness, and then trying to cover these bills, you can see how it could really quickly get out of control.
I think there's been a lot of focus when we think of the effects of the Affordable Care Act on, fewer emergency room visits, people are overall physically healthier. But you're like saying, but look at the impact. People are healthy enough to go to work. People are not getting dunned for unpaid medical bills, on and on and on. So that financial health is really, I think it's probably not had the attention paid to it.
I totally agree. And I mean, I think all of these things are connected. So I think your ability to afford your health care can improve your health. It can improve your finances. If you have better finances, you might be less stressed out. That could feed back into your physical health as well. And I think the other thing to remember is that every unpaid medical bill is not just a stress for the consumer, but that's revenue for the hospital as well. So there are economic impacts that extend beyond just the consumer's well-being. The flip side of that is that hospitals are getting more revenue.
And I was struck by the fact you found the positive effects of enrolling grow over time. So this is, we haven't seen the end of the benefits. And you also say, on the flip side, the people who do not have it, you see those negative effects deepen.
That's right. There was an interesting study that looked at Tennessee, which is it had kind of a unique situation in the mid-2000s where they were actually kicking people off of Medicaid instead of enrolling people on Medicaid, which is what we had in Michigan. And people and the researchers that studied that, who are at UVA and the Federal Reserve as well, found that when people got kicked off, you saw the flip side. As you can imagine, that unpaid bills went up, that financial distress went up, that more financial problems occurred. So I think you're absolutely right that it's kind of a two-way street. As you sort of allow more people to enroll, you get these benefits. But then when you kick people off, either because you restrict eligibility or maybe you implement new work requirements or other sort of restrictions in the program, then you're going to see things reverse.
In fact, that you've just actually teed up the question I wanted to get your thoughts on. We're seeing, the state trying to implement work requirements on Medicaid recipients. How do you think those will affect the Healthy Michigan people that you studied?
My guess would be that what we'll see essentially is the benefits that we saw when they enrolled will go in the other direction. So when we were seeing in Michigan specifically, we saw decreased bankruptcies, we saw decreased overdrawing your credit card, decreased unpaid bills. When people enrolled, my guess would be that when they are kicked off because of work requirements, these will just go in the other direction. direction. People that get kicked off will experience more delinquencies and more bankruptcies.
And then opening the lens more widely, of course, we've seen one attempt after another from the GOP and the Trump administration to do away with the Affordable Care Act. If that should happen, clearly you expect negative financial impact. And is there anything that could keep that from being, have you heard any alternate plan that would keep that from being the case?
That's a good question. There was a recent report from the Census Bureau that found, sort of for the first time since the Affordable Care Act, that the uninsurance rate in the U.S. actually has gone up in the last year. All previous years, it had been going down. So I think there is some evidence of some erosion of some of the gains that we've seen through the Affordable Care Act. Now, it went up by, I believe, 0.8%. So we're not talking about a massive spike. But it does seem that some of the efforts of the Trump administration to
curtail. Yeah, they've shortened the enrollment period.
Exactly. And they've decreased marketing. They've decreased funding that are going to facilitators that help people mm-hmm. enroll, that has had a negative impact on people's ability to enroll. Now, on the flip side, many states expanded Medicaid eligibility under Trump that refused to do so under Obama. So there are forces that are working in both directions. And I do think, you know, in a way, perhaps almost ironically, the fact that there's no longer Obama in the White House, which has sort of been was a political stopping point for a lot of Republican mm-hmm. governors, has maybe given them more flexibility to take up these expansions, especially when they see, and I think this was a very compelling argument in Michigan, that there are a lot of economic benefits of doing so. And it's not just about alleviating poverty. It's about helping hospitals stay open, increasing hospital revenue, and the sort of employment and workforce effects of that. It really is a winning proposition for a lot of states. There was an analysis that was done about Michigan's expansion around the time that it occurred that found that actually a lot of the services that are going to be covered by Medicaid were already being paid for by the state in one way or another, so that the state budget actually came out ahead when these services began to be covered by Medicaid. They had different mental health programs. The state was just paying for health care for people exiting correctional facilities that the state was paying for. And that all got largely covered by the federal government when they adopted the expansion. So the idea that states can't afford to expand, it doesn't hold a lot of water. At least it didn't here in Michigan. And so I think that that was the right choice.
University of Michigan researcher Sarah Miller. She was part of a team of social scientists who explored the ways that health insurance improves financial health. The research is being published in the Journal of Public Economics. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
My pleasure.
The future for more than 9,000 mental health counselors in Michigan is unclear after the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, LARA, announced proposed updates to licensing rules that cover these counselors. Now, the counselors say the rule changes would strip them of their ability to diagnose and treat some 150,000 patients. LARA says, well, it's just bringing the rules into sync with existing law, which never allowed licensed professional counselors to diagnose and use psychotherapy techniques to treat their patients. So let's try to sort all this out as we say hello to Carol Thompson, who is covering this story for the Lansing State Journal. Carol, what are the rules that LARA wants to change, and why are they doing this?
Well, LARA has said that the current rules are outdated and in need of an update. And one thing they really want to do is to move the two words diagnose and psychotherapy from a section that defines what counselors can do and put it into a section on required education. And the problem seems to be that there are discrepancies, like you said, between the Michigan law that covers counselors and then the state rule that really lays out what they can do. The law does not explicitly say that they could diagnose, at least in terms of their scope of practice. Mm-hmm. But until now, the rule has put it there, at least as it's been interpreted. So the state wants to rearrange it, and a lot of counselors are worried that that means they won't be able to serve their clients.
Yeah, as I read your piece for the Lansing State Journal, it seems pretty clear if state law going back 30 years did not specifically allow counselors to diagnose and treat mental illness, how have they been doing that for three decades?
That is a question I put to Laura and did not get a clear answer on. I asked whether counselors had been diagnosing in violation of the statute. And the response I got from Laura was that the current rules are outdated, they don't align with statute, and it's been confusing. They didn't directly answer the question, yes or no.
Okay. So they're saying we want to tweak these rules to align them clearly with this 30-year-old law.
Yeah.
Okay. Certainly there's agreement that demand for mental health care is growing, and that's putting a real strain on the system's ability to provide mental health care. What are we hearing? How could these rule changes that Laura wants to make impact that problem with delivering mental health care in Michigan?
Well, there are more than 9,000 licensed professional counselors in Michigan, and surely everyone has hundreds, if not thousands, of clients. And there is research out of the University of Michigan that shows there is a nationwide shortage of mental health workers and increasing demand for mental health care. So if counselors, you know, if their fears are realized and that they're stopped from practicing, a lot of people could be left without care.
So we know, Carol, the association representing the counselors is staunchly against changing the rules. What is the Michigan Psychological Association's view?
Well, they seem to support the rule change and be in favor of really spelling out diagnosis and psychotherapy techniques as something that licensed professional counselors should have in their education. And one representative from the Michigan Psychological Association told me that there are counselors who are experienced and may be very good counselors, but she is afraid that they don't have adequate education to do what they're doing.
So if Laura is able to enact these updated rules, could counselors then go back and get more training to be able to diagnose and treat patients? I mean, what kind of options would they have?
So a counselor I interviewed did say that that was something that she could do. She also said she would consider changing career paths or moving out of state.
So counselors are saying that this rule change, Carol, could strip them of their ability to make a living and to diagnose and treat their patients. Could they do that with more training?
That is a possibility. One of the counselors I interviewed for this story said that her three choices would be going back to school, moving out of state, or changing career paths.
Okay. How do these proposed updates that Laura wants to make, how does that compare to rules governing mental health counselors in other states?
Well, other states have different rules for mental health counselors. None deny counselors the authority to diagnose clients, but other states don't explicitly authorize it. That's according to research from the University of Michigan. And some states make distinctions between clinical counselors and other professional counselors, but it really depends on what state someone is practicing in.
Yeah, so there's nothing hard and fast. Now, you also report the state house has made an effort to change that 30-year-old law. Tell us what happened on that front.
Well, there is a bill in the House right now that counselors are supporting. It's HB 4325. And that would basically change the law to match the rules right now. And it would put the term clinical counseling principles, methods, or procedure within counselor's scope of practice, therefore allowing them to diagnose and treat issues.
Okay, which would basically, when Laura says, gee, we're just aligning our rules with the existing law, then this is taking the existing law and kind of codifying what people are doing, what these counselors are doing.
Right.
What's the status of that bill?
It's still in the House, and it's been introduced before in other sessions, but counselors are excited about it this time and feel confident that it will move forward.
All right. And there is a public hearing on this issue tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. in the G-Men and Williams building in Lansing. And it's Laura having a hearing on putting these rewritten rules out for public comment. So we have Laura planning these reworked rules to take away counselors' ability to diagnose and treat. And we've got this House bill that would allow them to continue diagnosing and treating. So what's next?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on which moves forward first. if it's the rule or if it's the bill.
What will you be watching for?
Okay. I'd like to hear more from the state in terms of if these rules become official that they're proposing right now, are they going to write a letter to every counselor, and what will that letter say? I think there seems to be a lot of confusion about whether counselors really will be told you can no longer practice the way you have been practicing, or whether it's like the state says and they're just cleaning up some old confusing rules.
Carol Thompson, Lansing State Journal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.